All right. This is going to be, obviously, since we spent the first part talking off tape about Azerbaijan and Israel, now let's talk about the Song of Songs. First of all, for this class, those of you who haven't been here before, you don't need to read Hebrew and you don't need any previous familiarity with anything in the text, but what you will need is the text. Now, it will not help for you to get the Bible that we use in synagogue on Saturday morning because it doesn't have any of the Song of Songs in it. So that's not a Jewish Bible. It is the five books of the Torah and certain selections from the Haftarah, which means from the second part of the Jewish Bible, and I'll explain what I mean in a minute. The Hebrew Bible is what's called a step canon. A canon is a collection of sacred books. Step, because it's in three parts, which are each in some ways of lesser importance, in other ways not, don't take it too. But obviously the most important are the five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, from Bereshit to Devarim. And that's what we read in a cycle every year. Most people call that the Torah. And you can call that the Torah. The Torah has like a restricted meaning and also a broader meaning. You can also call almost anything that people teach the Torah. And before I finish, let me tell you a beautiful thing that the rabbi of one of the synagogues said about Abraham in last week's portion. Don't let me forget it. It's such a beautiful bit of Torah I want to tell you. But also, Torah is all of the Hebrew Bible. Because if you think about it, you know that you've heard mention of all these books that you know somehow are Jewish books, but maybe like the Song of Songs, or the book of Job, or you know that there's a prophet Isaiah, but you don't know where he comes from or where he went to. In other words, the Hebrew Tanakh, and that's what it's called in Hebrew, Torah, Nevi'im, Nevi'im means prophets, Ketuvim, Ketuvim are writings. The Nevi'im, the prophets, include the historical books, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, like David, King David, that's all in the Nevi'im. But it also includes the prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are the major prophets, and then there are the minor prophets. They're called minor not because they're less important, but because they have small books. Joel, Amos, Obadiah, on and on. Right, there are 12 of them. The Treas are, they're called, the 12. And then the third part, the Ketuvim, the writings, which is what the Song of Songs is in, are all the Megillot. Do you ever wonder where Esther came from? I mean, Esther is in the writings. And so are Psalms and Proverbs and Song of Songs and Job and Daniel and Esther and Jonah and on and on. So if you get, will you hold that up? Just hold up the JPS Tanakh, which every home should have, the JPS Tanakh. That will give you all the Hebrew Bible, except in English. You can get a dual language edition, too, of the JPS Tanakh that will give it to you all in Hebrew and English. Any Torah that it says Tanakh or any translation of the Song of Songs you can bring. There are lots of translations of the Song of Songs out there, so any one of them is okay. The Song of Songs is one of those books that's translated in lots of various ways. It's not easily understood exactly who's speaking. We'll talk about this when we get there, but it's basically what we're about to study is a love poem. That's what it is. There's no other way to put it. I mean, as you'll see, it's an erotic love poem. It's not just a love poem. And so what is interesting about the Song of Songs, of course, is why it's in the Tanakh. Because believe me, if I just gave it to you and said, would you find this in the Bible? You would say, of course not. There's no reason why this should be in the Bible. Where he's talking about, he's comparing her breasts to towers. Why would that be in the Bible? Therefore, you understand that the rabbis interpreted it not as a love poem between a man and a woman, but as a love poem between Israel and God. And the church, by the way, did the same thing, thought it was between the church and God. So it's allegorical. But we're going to study it on four different levels, which is the way the rabbis see the Torah in general and the way Michael Fishbane's beautiful commentary on the Song of Songs sees it. The Hebrew word pardes, which really means paradise, you may have heard of in other contexts, the rabbis used the word pardes to describe the way all of Torah can be seen, but especially the Song of Songs. And that stands for pshat, drash, remez, and sod. pshat. You don't have to remember these words, but you'll hear them probably enough over the next however many months that they'll take some root in your consciousness. Pshat means the simple meaning. Now, the simple meaning is never the simple meaning. If I say to you, for example, God, it's hot in here, I'm burning up, the simple meaning is not that I'm burning up. The simple meaning is that I'm hot. So the simple meaning means the plain meaning in context of what someone is saying. So if he says your breasts are like towers, the simple meaning is not that her breasts are like towers. The simple meaning is that he's complimenting the beauty of her breasts, right? That's the simple meaning. That's the pshat, okay? The drash is the interpretive meaning. That is, what does it mean to say that in the context of Israel's relationship to God, since that's how the rabbis read the Torah. And everything in here, the rabbis will read in one way or another as saying something about the relationship between the Jewish people, Jewish history, something, and God. Remez means hint. And the hint is about the way in which the poem is talking about the human soul. And all of it, in terms of the progress of the soul, the growth of the soul, the way the individual soul comes closer to God, since it's a very personal poem, all of it has that aspect to it as well. And then Sod is the mystical interpretation of the Song of Songs. Now, if you've ever, and we'll talk about all four levels, which means we're going to go through the verses fairly slowly, but the truth is it's not a plot. It's not like something happens at the end. That's not why you read the Song of Songs. It's a poem. If you study Jewish mysticism, even if you just read a good book on Jewish mysticism, I don't know why it's so hot in here today. I'm sorry for that. I know you're burning up. I'm sure that's why subconsciously I came up with that. I wouldn't have been so formal had I known. I figure I got a full day and the IDF dinner is tonight, so I figured I would just dress for. The mystical literature is highly erotic. It's one of the reasons why you've heard that phrase that you're not supposed to study mysticism unless you're 40, but that's not actually what the law is. You're supposed to be 40 and married with children before you study the mystical literature. And one of the reasons is because there's a lot of sexual imagery in the mystical literature. And the reason that there is sexual imagery is that the mysticism is very much about the closeness of the human being to God and the best available vocabulary that human beings have for intimate closeness is sexual vocabulary, right? You can't say like, we're really good friends. You're not if you want to talk about devekut, which means clinging, and some talk about, there's a big debate among mystical scholars in Judaism about whether Judaism talks about unio mystica, which means union with God, right? Christian mysticism talks about union with God. Some Jewish scholars think that Jewish mysticism doesn't talk about union, that there's always a separation, but other scholars argue, no, that it does, but you can understand why union is going to be sexual imagery. So if you turn then to the Bible to look for where do you find this imagery, this is where you find it. You find it in the Song of Songs. So the Song of Songs became really important for Jewish mystical literature because it provided that imagery. Gerson Cohen, many years ago, who was the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary and an extraordinary intellect and a brilliant historian. And I remember when he became chancellor of the seminary, all these people saying that it was a shame because he moved into an administrative post and we lost a great historian. But he wrote this brilliant article about why the Song of Songs was included in the Bible. And his theory, which makes sense, is the rabbis felt this tremendous love for God and felt like God had this tremendous love for them. And they looked in the Bible and they didn't see any book that expressed what they knew. It's not just they felt it, they knew they felt for God and God felt for them. And so when they came across the Song of Songs, they felt like, oh, it is here. It's just veiled. And so that's why Rabbi Akiva says all, and this is Rabbi Akiva talking, no small, I mean, we named our school after him. He said, all the Torah is holy, the Song of Songs is the Holy of Holies. Right. So you can see the status that it had. And Rabbi Akiva, if you know anything about the way he taught, for him, love was probably more prominent than among any of the other great rabbis, right? He's the one who says in Pirkei Avot, it is with great love that God created human beings, but with even greater love that God let us know that he created us with love. So, and who said the great verse of the Torah was V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, that the greatest verse of the Torah was you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That was Rabbi Akiva's view. So you can understand why a book like the Song of Songs would particularly draw Rabbi Akiva. Yeah. Okay, so let's take questions and comments and then we'll wrap it up. Go ahead. Yes.
Is Song of Songs the same as Tehillim or is it something?
No, Tehillim are Psalms. The Song of Songs is Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, also called the Song of Solomon. And let me just say a word about that. We'll come back to this. The rabbis thought that Solomon wrote Song of Songs, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. Those were his three books. And their view of it, one view in the Talmud, is that he, those of you who remember studying Ecclesiastes will understand why, that he wrote Song of Songs when he was a young man. That he wrote Proverbs when he was a middle-aged man. And he wrote Kohelet Ecclesiastes when he was an old man. Which is really, it's beautiful, yeah. You were going to say?
You read my mind.
Oh, okay.
I don't yeah. have to ask.
Rabbi, you wanted to talk about the sermon about Abraham.
I asked, but at the very end, thank you for reminding me. Don't let me forget. After the questions, I will. Yes, he did. But then when he returned, he did. But, you know, he was going off to college. So he left his, he said, isn't Rabbi Akiva also the one who left his wife for decades to go study? And the answer is yes. Then when he came back, by the way, there's a beautiful story in the Talmud. Granted that he left for a long time. Okay. But then when he comes back, so she rushes out to greet him and all of his students crowd her out. And he tells them all to move away. He says, because everything I am and everything you are is from her. So he acknowledged her sacrifice in allowing him to become Rabbi Akiva, but yeah, he was gone for a long time. And there was no instant messaging, there was no, you know, there was no FaceTime. I mean, he was like gone. Yeah.
Just like Moses going to the mountain and
yeah.
back.
Yeah. I mean the sacrifices of the tension between domestic responsibility and public duty is a continuing theme, and for most of history it's also the tension between women and men, because public duty is almost always men for most of history and family and home is almost always women. So yeah, but that's a particularly, I mean, you wouldn't want to be Moses' wife, seriously, you wouldn't want to be Moses' wife. So yeah,
you talked about the Shah, the Hin, and the Son. What's the fourth?
Pshat. Pishat is the first. It's Pishat, P-S-H-A-T. The second is, I was reminded in Azerbaijan how hard it is to hear foreign languages if you don't know them. They would say the same guy's name four times, and I still couldn't tell you his name. So the first is Pshat, P-S-H-A-T. The Iranians on the trip had a big advantage because there are many words in the Azeri language that have their origin in Farsi or sound like Farsi or
it was just as hard for me.
Was it?
Yes.
Good, I feel better.
Yeah.
The people who spoke Russian could talk to them in Russian because all of the people we met with spoke Russian. But Drash is the second, D-R-A-S-H. The third hint is Remez, R-E-M-E-Z. And the last one is Sod, S-O-D. Okay? Now let me tell you what the rabbi said about Abraham. I thought this was great, and I'm sure you will hear it again, but I will tell you the first time. So last week, Abraham is with God. God visits Abraham, the rabbis say, because after circumcision, God is doing Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick. So God is with Abraham, and the strangers come. They turn out to be angels, right? But he sees them first as strangers. And he immediately, you know, he tells Sarah to go and make food, and he goes out and greets them and brings them into the tent. So the rabbis comment on this, greater is greeting the stranger than receiving the divine presence. Because Abraham turns away from God and he receives the strangers who come to his tent, okay? So you've got the background. So in other words, the biblical comment is that Abraham, it doesn't say Abraham turned away from God. It's just one verse says God was with Abraham. The next verse, Abraham is greeting strangers, okay? So the Talmudic interpretation of that is Abraham left God's presence to go greet the strangers. The next one is the rabbi quoted the Gera Rebbe, the Gera Rebbe was the spot, it's a series of Jewish scholars called the Gera Rebbe. I don't know if it was the Svatimet or his father. But anyway, the Gera Rebbe says, all right, so we understand that it is greater to greet the stranger than to greet God's presence. But how did Abraham know that? How did he have the chutzpah to turn away from God and greet strangers? We can do it and say, well, Abraham did it. But how could Abraham do that? You can't turn away from God and greet strangers. And his answer is, which is such a beautiful answer, he said, because that's what it means to be in God's presence, is to want to enact, to do a mitzvah. It wasn't that Abraham turned to the strangers in spite of God being there, but Abraham turned to the strangers because God was there. Isn't that a beautiful question and answer? I thought it was like if I went to Azerbaijan just to get that, it would be worth it. So it's also a beautiful explanation of mitzvah, that mitzvah comes out of your sense of God's presence, because you can't be in God's presence and not want to do something to make God's world better. So there were these three strangers, and Abraham was in God's presence, so of course he was going to go greet them. Anyway, I just thought that was like beyond. Yes?
Just because I learned this last week, when you said that the book of Psalms about like the ecstasy or the love to God,
yes,
it was very interesting. When Moses sent the 12 spies to Israel, mm-hmm. Eldad and Medad, they come back and they are, no, none of them.
No, Yehoshua and Caleb.
Yeah, and they come and they are in a state of ecstasy and mm-hmm. become.
Right. So, well, that's the other, it is a very interesting thing that the prophets, many of them, are described as being in states of ecstasy. And they're characterized by, if you want to see, I mean, it sounds like a strange thing to say, but if you want to see the kind of ecstatic religious state that is described by the prophets, go to one of these churches where people speak in tongues, right? One of these fundamentalist evangelical churches where you will see people in states of religious ecstasy. And that's exactly how now I'm not drawing an analogy between Ezekiel but if you want to see it, that's the kind of religious ecstasy that's described. Look, the prophets did some very strange things. Some walked around the city naked. They were not usual people, the prophets. They were very unusual people. And part of it was this ecstatic state that Saul falls into too in the book of David, if you remember. And their comment when Saul falls into a state of ecstasy, the comment is Saul too among the prophets? Because that's how people prophesied. If you've ever gone to a religious fortune teller or soothsayer, they also go into this trance-like state. Whether it's real or not real, I don't know. I'm assuming some are real and some are not. I gotta believe that some people who give prophecies or tell fortunes believe themselves that they're doing it honestly. I'm sure there are many con men, but I'm also sure that there are people who do it sincerely. Whether it's true or not is a different question. But that they believe that it's true, I don't doubt. Yes, Norm, and then we'll wrap it up.
In our class, when we were talking about the prophets, we said that many times prophets are losses.
Yes. So the way that Yochanan Mofs, for example, who is a biblical scholar, and Heschel talk about the prophets is that the prophet is an intercessor. The prophet stands between the people and God and defends the people to God and defends God to the people. So Moses is, that's why Moses is the prophet. When God wants to destroy Israel, Moses says, don't do it. If you're going to do it, destroy me too. In other words, he defends the people against God, and he's always obviously defending God against the people. So the prophet stands between the two, which is an interesting way to think about it. All right. And with that, next week we will actually start the Song of Songs.